That's cool with me.
I find some of these chats are best when they're off cuff and a bit more off script and a bit more natural. But yeah, great to connect and have you with me.
No problem.
How's your day going, anyway?
Yeah, not bad so far. Busy, actually. I've got quite a few things today. I've got a meeting after this, and I had one at 1 o'clock, and I realised I wasn't going to have any time for lunch, and that's now been moved to three, so it's one of those afternoons, really.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's crack on and, go straight into it. So
okay, cool.
We'll officially go live in 3, 2, 1. Hey, guys, it's Ben Parry from Startup Chats. It's great to have you with me. We've got James Mulvaney, founder of Podcast Co and Radio Co. So I'm really excited to have James join me. Basically, James is anything to do with podcasting and everything like that. He is the man. So probably, James, if you just sort of kick off and just tell us about yourself. How did you get into podcasting? That's a good start.
Yeah, so I'm my name's James Mulvaney. Yeah, I'm an entrepreneur. I have two different software companies, as Ben just mentioned. I've got radio.co and podcast.co. Both are doing quite exciting things in the audio space, along with matchmaker.fm, which I'm guessing we'll get on to talk about later. But my story really was when I was 16, I wanted to go into radio. I wanted to be a DJ, and I always loved listening to the radio, always loved presenting and sort of showing off to my friends and stuff. So I thought, you know, that'd be an interesting career. So I started doing the normal things you do, getting work experience working in the radio industry. At the same time, I was a little bit of a nerdy kid. So I was kind of sat behind my computer building websites and things. And I ended up just kind of merging the two together, went off to university and sort of the radio thing took a back foot. But what I did do then was built a company selling to the radio industry, because I'd kind of built enough knowledge in my kind of couple of years when I was 16, 17, 18 to know about the industry. And I thought, well, there's an opportunity here to sort of sell streaming media services. This was back in like 2004, 2005. You know, the internet was still quite young, and it was a complicated problem that a lot of radio stations didn't know how to take their broadcast and put it online. So that's how I got started. I basically was the guy that would help them turn their broadcast from a sort of FM signal to a digital signal that people could then listen to on the internet.
Wow.
And
fantastic.
Then obviously, yeah, then we kind of progressed to start building mobile apps when iPhone launched and that sort of thing. So yeah, that was really kind of how I got started. And podcasting really came as a sort of natural progression, I think, because podcasts are kind of the new radio, if you like. Sure. Although I still think radio is still very prominent, and I don't think it's going anywhere anytime soon. But, you know, of course, podcasts are a brand new medium that's kind of had this resurgence. Well, not so much a new medium, but it's had this kind of brand new resurgence over the past few years. And, I think more and more people are adopting them as a way of communicating, which is really exciting.
Yeah, it's an exciting space to be in. I think one thing I certainly love about podcasting is the fact that, unlike radio, you can pause it or you can stop it and pick it up later. And you can just do other things, like, you know, video is a great format, of course, but it consumes your attention. Whereas I think podcasting, you know, like, I'll give you an example. Like last night, literally, I came home, did some food shopping, plugged my Bluetooth headphones in, and literally just popped all the bits away in the cupboards as I was listening to a podcast.
That's exactly it.
Very exciting.
While you're cooking, while you're doing housework, whatever, at the gym, it's brilliant, isn't it?
100%. So, James, obviously, you know, I'm really intrigued in people's sort of journeys and how they got to where they got to, how they launched and things like that. And at the moment, we're really trying to focus on that pre-launch process that sometimes people do go through or don't go through. And sometimes people just do stuff and they don't realize maybe they even do like a pre-launch strategy. So it'd be really interesting to sort of maybe dive a bit deeper in terms of that moment and you thinking about you creating a business. I mean, would it be maybe if we talk about, you know, your businesses now, how you know, which one came first and how you sort of came with the idea and then thought about launching it and going from there. So if you can just dive into that, that'd be great.
Yeah, I've got an interesting way to sort of discuss this, really, because the way we approached launching radio.co and podcast.co was very different. Radio.co was kind of effectively bootstrapped. I sort of funded it from my then existing business, and, you know, we built it very slowly over the course of about 2-3 years. Launched in 2015, Radio.co grew really quickly and it was very successful in a very short space of time. With podcast.co, we probably 2-3 years after we launched radio, we thought podcasting seemed a natural progression for us. You know, I obviously have a team who work with me, so we do pretty much everything in-house. You know, we have an in-house development team, we have videographers, so we have production capacity. Obviously, we do all of our own marketing, etc. So we thought, you know, podcasting was more and more clients were asking for podcasting. We thought, do we build it into the existing platform or do we create a new service, a new platform, and sort of treat it as a standalone thing? So we opted for the latter. Obviously, I was conscious that we didn't want to take away the momentum from our first product, radio.co, or first business. So it seemed sensible to sort of raise some money to effectively fund the development and launch of podcast.co. So instead of going out to take investment, I decided to raise some debt equity, which is basically borrowed against the existing business, but obviously you have to pay that money back. So you're not debt financing, so you're not giving away any equity. That was kind of the route we went down. Did first round, kind of thought, yeah, okay, we could launch this as an MVP within 6 months. Now, development, this has been my sort of track record historically. I always try and be overconfident on how long it takes a development team to deliver a product. I think that's probably a good thing because I think it keeps pressure on them. In reality, it always takes them a lot longer than you sometimes predict. So it didn't really take a year to build podcast. It didn't take 6 months to build podcast.co. It ended up taking more like a year. So obviously it was a lot more costly to create than perhaps I hoped.
Then I think that development cycle definitely can take a lot longer than you expect and hope, especially, yeah. I mean, you know, I'm not a techie sort of coder. You know, it's almost like, you know, I keep setting deadlines for my own sort of startup and, you know, we keep going, yeah, we've done that, but then we've got these challenges. And yeah. I guess when you're trying to maybe create something from scratch that hasn't been done before, sometimes you just don't know how long things are going to take.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a common thing. I think there's very few startups that will build and launch a product according to the original plan or schedule. Like, this is just the nature of the game. You know, there's things that crop up. Part of the challenge we had as well was actually recruitment, because it's become, you know, we're based here in Manchester, and I moved to Manchester 10 years ago just after I graduated. It seemed like a great place to build a sort of set up shop because there's three universities here, so I thought, brilliant, can hire lots of technical talent. And at that stage I'd built a business and it was just me, so I was like ready to start hiring. You know, fast forward sort of 6-7 years, it looks like the landscape is very different. There's a lot more competition in terms of hiring good developers. Also, the salaries are kind of more on par with London salaries now. You know, back then it was really cheap to hire developers compared to London, you know, in Manchester. Now it's kind of probably leveled out a bit. And obviously there's more bigger companies who you're competing against. So it's interesting because obviously when you're actually trying to build a new platform like we were, we wanted to hire a new team to build a platform. So actually part of that year was just trying to recruit and you know, on board people, because it's nice to think, oh, you can hire a team of 5 developers and have them all start on the same day. That's not realistic. So really what happened to us was, you know, we hired a couple which started within sort of a month of each other, then we had to wait like for someone else to come on board, and he had like a 3-month notice period. So these developers were starting over the period of like 6 months, and it was like, you know, we were sort of started to chip away at bits of the product, but of course you have to factor that in.
And rolling it back slightly, what was the, just going back to the radio, is it Radio Co?
Yeah.
Yeah, so what was the core offering there, and how is that different to the new podcast? Is it Matchmaker, or was it Podcast Pro, or
Podcast? Well, podcast.co is a platform for podcasters.
Yeah.
Radio.co is a live streaming platform for radio stations. So, are two
very different markets.
Yeah, but obviously a lot of radio stations have podcasts, but not very many podcasters are really interested in a radio station. So there is some crossover between our two customer bases there, but there's also, you know, a bigger opportunity there in podcasting. There's a lot more businesses starting podcasts.
Yeah, I guess with the first one, it was a bit like a business-to-business type
relationship. It's quite niche. Yeah.
And a lot of that learning, that technology, you can sort of bring over to the almost more consumer facing Joe Public who wants to be a podcaster type service, and that's where you're pushing the new entity effectively. Is that right?
That's exactly it. Yeah. And you know, the thing is, Ben, when you go through that process of launching a platform, a software as a service platform, the first time around, You know, you make lots of mistakes, you learn along your way. And same goes for marketing as well, because obviously the development is just one part of that sort of cycle. You know, you've then got to actually start getting customers through the door. So certainly with podcast.co, we were much more well equipped when we launched in terms of marketing, because actually whilst we were building the platform, we set up a website, started creating content and sort of building authority on that domain. So by the time we launched, we already had traffic coming through the door. We made the mistake when we built radio.co sort of 4 years prior to just have like a standard landing page with an email opt-in and really nothing on the site apart from that on the gear up to launch. And of course, you then started from scratch in terms of your SEO and everything. So, you know, because that takes time. It takes time for Google to sort of start trusting your domain. It doesn't happen overnight. And
no, definitely. I think that's a really interesting example. In the sense of, you know, when you did your first business, you pretty much, it sounds like you did what most people do is maybe you have at most a landing page with a lead capture. So you maybe send them an email update saying we're coming soon, bear with us type thing.
Which could sit there for 2 years, you know, which you did. But you know, that's a complete waste of time. You know, what you should be doing is actually, even if you've got nothing to sell, start building a community and start building an audience.
So moving into when you sort of were pre-planning to count down for the launch of the new platform, what were the sort of, I guess, again, to give the audience some ideas and inspiration, what were the sort of some things that you did? Did you have that same landing page where you had to sign up for your emails, for notifications as well, and then you did other things? Or how did you sort
of... Obviously, you want to collect email addresses on any website you create, for sure. But it was really about the content strategy. So rather than just having a landing page saying coming soon, we were actually created effectively an information resource about podcasting, which we worked on, and we were pushing up articles on a probably bi-weekly basis for the space of like the year that we were building the platform, you know, just on helping the community and how to start a podcast, you know, how to write a podcast script, just going after these kind of long tail keywords that we know people are researching, and just trying to deliver as much value up front. And of course, the name of the game is then you capture email address. So when you've then got the product to launch, you've got an happy email list of, you know, potential customers. Not everyone's going to sign up, but of course, some will then show interest. And you know, you can kind of hit the ground running a little bit more.
Oh, fantastic. And did you, so that was very much, you know, I guess, SEO driven type of interaction and engagement and driving interest. Did you have a social strategy as well leading up to the launch, or was that sort of put on the back burner until you launched?
We had a social strategy. It was kind of quite loose at the time. One of the things that we did do, which worked pretty well, was we ran a competition. So we bought a load of equipment, like podcasting gear, probably about $2,000-$3,000 worth. We wanted to make it a decent, substantial prize. And we basically said, you know, we kind of did this kind of cheesy 80s infomercial video. Right. So it was kind of a bit of a viral campaign.
Yeah.
It worked. It didn't work as well as perhaps I thought it might, but it was great fun to actually create this.
Yeah.
And effectively we said, you know, if you enter the competition, you share it with your friends, you know, you can get more entries. And the idea is you get lots of people who want this big package of fancy equipment. They share it with their friends, who then share it with their friends, and obviously you build up your social presence, and also again it helps building your email database. So it worked pretty well. Again, we'd never tried anything like that before. I certainly would try it again. I think perhaps maybe doing fewer competitions. Not as bigger prize package. Just like make them more frequent with smaller prize packages. That's kind of, I think, would be my approach, because we did actually spend that much on equipment, and then obviously we had to ship it all across the winner, who was in the US. So it was quite an expensive operation. But if you look at the amount of leads we generated, I think we got to about 10,000 entries. So probably spending about $2,000-$3,000. So it's not too bad if you think about it, because those are obviously hot leads. They're all interested in podcasting. They all want to start podcasts. So it was really relevant traffic to us.
Fantastic. Yeah, absolutely. And what about the whole influencer landscape? Have you explored that any further, or have you used that sort of resource to sort of boost your brand, or did you do it at the beginning?
No, I've never really played or used internet with influencer marketing much. I mean, again, I think it's quite good if you've got physical products, you know, if you've got like a widget or something you're promoting, or fashion lighting. I'm not sure how influencer marketing works with software, apart from, you know, maybe getting the odd review here and there. And you tend to kind of get those anyway, I think, if your product's good. one of the things that, you know, we are obviously interested in at the moment, and this is probably kind of a nice little segue to talk about Matchmaker, is you know, connecting podcasters and guests and the kind of more human side of podcasting, the social aspect of it. You know, and obviously we've now built Matchmaker to a community of about 10,000 people, and a lot of them are, you know, influencers, they might be business leaders, you know, obviously people who are creating podcasts for the companies, but also a lot of people are doing it out of passion as well. So I think that's kind of really interesting. Again, it's totally different for us as a business, because we're typically software as a service. We've never really created like a community like this before, but it's been really, really exciting journey so far.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because right from the get-go, almost you were creating a community without necessarily realizing you could create a community by creating helpful resources and guides and put yourself out there to help others. And I think that's it's an interesting angle that potentially, you could explore, you know, whether, you know, obviously when everything eases up, you know, go from virtual events to physical events and, you know, who knows what, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely.
So the launch, did you have like a big countdown, like a launch, you know, a party or a celebration or anything on social, or did you sort of make a big song and dance about it, or how did that go?
When we launched podcast.co, probably not. Like, I think the thing is, when you launch software platforms, it's always very stressful. There's always like millions of people running around in the office, kind of like going, ah, and of course, you know, there's always technical things to deal with, because suddenly you get, you know, there's this influx of customers and you're sort of, you know, you can't help but be a little bit taken off guard almost, because you've just been sat in there, not really having to deal with anyone in like code land, just sort of creating.
Yeah, you're in a safe space, aren't you? It's like you're in.
So we did.
And suddenly he's like, unleash the beast.
So we did. We did a private beta to begin with. So we basically wanted to make sure, you know, battle test the platform, make sure it was actually working. So that was probably between about February, March, 2019, and then we launched in, I think, June 2019. So yeah, on the lead up to it, we were sort of just making sure everything was in place. Launch day, of course, you know, then it's a case of you've got to start making some money and get some customers on board. Again, I think one of the benefits of having a private beta is, you know, you can give it away for free for a period of time, and obviously some of those people will then convert into paying customers, which is great. You know, again, it's a sort of like an elongated try before you buy. But obviously, when you sign up to one of these, you know, if you sign up to a product or service in beta, there's sometimes going to be a few bugs. But for us, we were quite lucky. There wasn't too many issues. It was stuff that we could easily iron out anyway.
Fantastic. And did the launch go as you hoped, and the initial sort of sign-ups, were they sort of, you know, coming through nicely? Were you pleased with that initial growth? Were you measuring that growth, sort of keeping an eye on sort of KPIs? Did you have an idea of the KPIs before you launched? You know, I think a lot of these things sometimes people don't consider, certainly before they launch, but having a game plan or something to aim for is certainly quite important.
Yeah, I agree. I think you need to be looking at your metrics and thinking, right, realistically, how many paying customers a day do we need to be signing up within the first sort of 6 months to 12 months? And obviously that then will change based on, you know, your performance. I think we weren't hitting our goal to begin with. It's kind of taken probably a year to sort of get there, really. You know, again, it's just like anything. You try and set your ambitions quite high, which I think is a good thing to do. But, you know, the reality is you don't always achieve what you want to achieve. You know, it takes time to build and grow a software company. You know, everyone knows that. Sometimes just as an entrepreneur, I think persistence is key. I think it's a really valuable thing to think, right, okay, we've just got to stick at this for as long as we can and just keep pushing. And eventually you start to see you getting where you want to be.
Definitely. You know what, James, I couldn't agree more. I think,
yeah,
you know, there are so many challenges when you're trying to build a SaaS business or a technology business or whatever, or any business, to be fair. There's so many challenges, particularly if you're trying to do something which maybe hasn't been done before, it was relatively new. And I think, you know, one of the biggest tips I can certainly give anybody listening is just to never, ever quit, never give up, and just you've got to keep battling through, because it isn't going to be a smooth ride.
No, it never is. And, you know, again, it's like I've had businesses in the past that have worked out really well. I've had businesses that have failed. And, you know, you've just got to give it your all and be prepared to adapt as well. Like, you know, when you launch a software product, I think your perception of what the demands of the market are can be sometimes wrong, or time could just change that demand. So like with podcast.co, for example, over the last year, we've added and innovated and we've changed lots of different things about the platform based on feedback. You've got to try and be reactive to what your customers are saying and what they want. And I think if you could do that, especially if you can do that within the first 1 to 2 years, you really set yourself up to be seen as a company that's kind of dynamic and exciting and people want to be associated with platforms like that. If you kind of just launch it and don't touch it and leave it like that for like the first year, people kind of get bored really easily. So I think people like to be seeing that you're being proactive and innovating and adding new features. And also it gives them that feeling like they're on the journey with you as well as a startup, I think.
Definitely. And James, how do you practically go about doing that in the sense of, you know, engaging with the community and getting feedback and all the rest of that?
I think for us, it's always the core sits at having really good customer success teams. So actually making sure that we're reachable and, you know, we have real people that they can speak to. You know, I think consumers are very much just like, a lot of the time they just think, oh, especially with the chat widgets on the side, they just think that they're talking to some bot or robot these days. So I think, you know, actually making sure that you're speaking to customers, listening to them and, you know, and encouraging them to have demos with you, encouraging them to actually speak to you about their ideas. You could learn a lot from them, really. You know, it's all very well thinking, you know, as a sort of CEO or a product designer, oh yeah, I've got this sorted, I know exactly what the audience wants. You don't always, you know, you can't always get it right the first time round. And I think, as I said before, you need to really be reactive to based on what people are saying. The way to do that is to make sure that you've got an open line of communication, and also, you know, have a feedback forum where people can request features. So, you know, again, it's useful. It's a way of sort of managing it. Different people do it in different ways. Some software companies now have a public roadmap. That's not something we've done, but we've kind of toyed with the idea a bit, just so you can show customers, potential customers, you know, what is coming up, what stuff you're working on. So there's, you know, various different ways you can do it, and lots of tools which make it easy now as well.
Definitely. I guess it's very much about constantly testing, constantly evolving, isn't it? Both in terms of the marketing strategy, in terms of testing and reiterating and tweaking that message and that, you know, and the aim, and measuring it and refining it as much as the product itself. You know, you've got to listen to the audience, you've got to, you know, actually get the feedback and actually, you know, implement those sort of changes. But equally, you know, you've got to make sure that, you know, it's a relatively decent sized audience who are also, you know, requesting the same sort of features.
Yeah, I was going to say there is such thing as feature creep. And, you know, if you listen to everyone's opinion and implement everything everyone says, you end up with this kind of weird Frankenstein of a product that no one actually wants to use. So, yeah, it's a fine balance, I think, between listening to people and making sure that, you know, you're not just saying, because sometimes you get one customer who will shout the loudest and they'll be jumping up and down saying, I want something to work in this way. And actually they're wrong, you know, or that's just their opinion of how it should work. So you've got to try and listen to your customer base as a whole. But as I say, having conversations is the way to do that, I think.
Yeah, definitely. And James, have you sort of looked into, I think they're like, I can't remember off the top of my head, but these sort of tools and clever solutions where you can actually look at how people are sort of onboarding and looking at the tools that they're using and their sort of, and when you release a new product, you know, whether you can actually see like data and see if that's having successes or not. Have you started to think about implementing any of those sort of technologies or do you at the moment just listen and get feedback?
We do. We have, I don't remember, I'm going to start forgetting names and stuff, so I'm not going to quote anything we use. But we do have various different things built into our product, which will allow us to like look at sort of conversion rates, user flow. We've recently added like a little widget, so at the top of the product, and again, we didn't do this with radio.co, we've now done this with Matchmaker and podcast.co, just like a little widget. So whenever we release like a feature update, even if it's like a minor tweak, we can tell people. You know, again, I think that's just like useful for people to know, and it kind of gives people that reassurance that they're not just sat on like a dead duck, and it's this, you know, it's thriving, it's moving forward, it's kind of good.
Fantastic. Yeah. And I think the beauty is for anyone who is looking to start their own business, there's so many clever data solutions in there to actually, you know, enable you to make smart decisions rather than just go, oh, I think this is the right thing to do, because Bob
Absolutely.
Sue from, you know, tech department said so, but yeah. You can actually look at the data and actually, you know, analyze it and refine it, tweak it, test it, and all the rest of it. What's the future now for Matchmaker and developing that community and pushing the business further forward?
Yeah, absolutely. So we've Matchmaker was a funny one because it came around by accident almost. When we launched podcast.co, we were looking at different ways we could funnel relevant traffic to our site. So we thought, well, obviously lots of podcasts are based around having guests on or interviews. So we created these two funnels. One was, are you a podcaster looking for better guests? Mm-hmm. And one was, do you want to get featured on podcasts as a guest? You know, you're an expert, you want to share your story, etc. And so we had these two like Google forms initially, and they were actually getting like quite a bit of traction. So it was almost like people completing a profile about themselves. We weren't just saying enter your name and email. We asked them a few more questions than that. So we would say, you know, tell us what your areas of expertise are, or tell us what sort of guests you're looking for. People were spending time filling these forms out. So we thought, this is actually how Matchmaker was born. We then thought, okay, why don't we actually make this thing? Because we actually had these two lists of people with no way of connecting them together.
Yeah,
and we kind of thought, well, we could sell podcasting to them, which is great. Yeah. We can do that. But we then saw this bigger opportunity. So we then back end of last year, we actually got like a junior development team who had just started. So we literally had, an MVP out the door by like February this year. And to our surprise, you know, it's really taken off. As I mentioned earlier, we've nearly hit 10K users in, I think it's 8 months since we launched. So really happy with that.
That's amazing.
So we're going to just continue like building upon it really. Like we've put some more resource on it now. So rather than just having a couple of developers, I think there's four working on it now. We are adding various features to sort of like looking at how we can monetize it as a platform. Yeah, obviously it's completely free. We want to try and keep it as free as possible for podcasters. With guests, we're going to introduce like a freemium model. And also looking at adding agency capability, because we've had a lot of PR agencies and influencer marketing agencies who basically represent like a handful of clients, and they want to represent them on our platform. So again, we're adding kind of functionality so you can control multiple profiles under one and that sort of thing.
It's really interesting, isn't it? How that has evolved from a funnel into Podcast.co, and now is enabled to be potentially a standalone entity in its own right and its own business.
Yeah.
So I think that's a really clever and interesting angle in terms of effectively creating value to help drive people into the Podcast.co business.
Yeah.
And yet eventually it can actually become something of its own.
Yeah.
I think it's a really interesting for anyone to think about, isn't it? Providing value to your audience via another solution other than your product, but then drives traffic to that product.
Absolutely. I mean, there's two benefits. Firstly, with Matchmaker, you know, we've built a big list of people who are really interested in podcasting. Which is obviously useful to us. So we can obviously use it as a tool to promote podcast.co, and it does work very well. We end up with a lot of signups who come via Matchmaker, who probably otherwise wouldn't have come across podcast.co. So they've came in via that funnel. But also as well, I just like as an entrepreneur, like, as I say, we've never built a community like this before. I've never done anything like this. What's really rewarding from my perspective is you have people message me and thanking me for sort of introducing them to it, saying, you know, this is brilliant. I've already had results. I've been on the platform like a day, and I've already reached out to three podcasts and got some bookings, or podcasts who have already booked like a bunch of interesting people. So the fact that people are actually using it and getting value from it is really, really exciting. I think there's so much we can do with this. We've got lots and lots of ideas of where we want to go, but it's certainly one of these things that, you know, a year ago I wouldn't have anticipated. It just has kind of come out of the blue. And again, I think as an entrepreneur, like you said before, sometimes you just got to keep your eyes open and look for opportunities that can come up, because you might start in one business doing one thing and then end up going down a completely different route. So it's again about sort of being reactive to what the market wants and sort of like looking for opportunities, really.
No, definitely. I call it my sort of secret invisible antenna. I've got this thing that's going in the background constantly. I'm like constantly looking around and it's like sussing things out. And I think it drives, you know, my wife mad, because I'm walking down, you know, having a nice walk down the beach, and suddenly, you know, I see something. I'm like, look at that.
Yeah. But then I think there's also like, because I've seen this in myself, you know, if I rewind 10 years, I was at university and I was one of these people, I was registering different domain names each week because I had a new business idea each week. And I think you've got to tame that beast to some extent, because otherwise you end up kind of just going off on all these different tangents. And obviously execution counts. But it's a case of, you know, we did a test, effectively, like a really, really low budget MVP. We validated an idea before we actually spent time creating a separate product and creating a brand, because obviously all that costs money. You've got developers to pay, and you know, once you set it up, you've got infrastructure to manage. So it's, you know, it needs to be taken with sort of consideration. You know, if you just kind of coming up with ideas and just sort of like not really executing very well, which is what I used to do. You know, sometimes you get a hit, but most of the time you'll get lots and lots of misses. You know, it's one of these things. It's kind of like, as an entrepreneur, it's finding that balance between, you know, going after every single opportunity you can think of and thinking, right, what do I really, really want to go after, and what's really going to make a big difference to our business?
Yeah, no, definitely. And at the same time, it's super, like you touched on earlier, super satisfying that you know that you're providing a huge amount of value and helping people connect. Yeah. You know, I think absolutely. That's, you know, and you know, certainly, you know, when you connected with me, I was like, this is phenomenal. You know, rarely do you, you know, get those messages from people, you know, on LinkedIn, for example, yeah. when all they're trying to do is just sell you something. It's like, oh,
it's becoming
interested.
A bit samey now, isn't it? Most of the time, I
it's
agree,
like,
yeah.
come on. And it's, you know, I think, you know, to a certain extent, you know, we're all trying to sell. Of course we are. And we all have to be, I think, mindful of everyone trying to do the hustling thing and all the rest yep. of it. But I think, you know, at the nice angle from your perspective was certainly the fact that, you know, this was just there to help me, and yep. there was nothing else, no ulterior motive. It was just, and I checked out, and I was like, actually, this is sick. This, you know, this is awesome. Makes my life so much easier, because I'm reigniting my podcast, and you know, this is certainly that challenge of trying to find, you know, interesting people to talk to and, yes. and all the rest of it. And certainly when you're starting out, you know, there's no way, you know, some big hitters are going to want to be bothered to waste their time with you. Unfortunately, that's just the yeah. reality of life. You know, as soon as you've got a big audience, then they'll be knocking on your door, which is, you know, maybe you'll say, you know, hey, do you remember that time when I asked you and you said, no, I'll see you later, go on your bike.
I think also, though, it's like, you know, the other thing as well is, if you're trying to do a podcast, and let's say you're trying to do one episode a week, it can become quite grueling after a while, trying to make sure that you've constantly got new people coming through the door. You know, 100%. I think a lot of people will immediately start with their immediate network, so people that they kind of know through business or friends, etc. And then, you know, after you've kind of burned through your kind of group of professional contacts, maybe you're like, okay, right, who do I go to now? It can be quite daunting. But the idea of Matchmaker really is because both sides are actively looking to be involved with the medium. That's why it works.
No, definitely. And from my perspective, it saved me so much time. And that's the beauty of it. And genuinely, you know, I'm quite happy to talk to anybody, because if I just talk about business and that stuff, it's really fascinating. And, you know,
you learn a lot by interviewing people, 100%. Like, it's really, and also by being interviewed, it's just you have conversations that with people you otherwise wouldn't have met. And this is why it's such a cool medium. And even if you haven't got like an audience of Joe Rogan, it doesn't matter, because you're still having these conversations, you're still learning, and you know, you're still putting out content that other people can use.
Definitely. And like you touched on, you know, you're able to network and create relationships that you'd never have met, you know, and people hopefully with similar interests, you know.
Yep.
You know, we're both interested in tech and technology and podcasting and that thing. And it's like, wow, you know, not all of my friends are. You know, if I'm talking about, you know, tech stuff or, you know, social media, or, you know, they just go, oh, whatever, I'm bored, you know, let's talk about the football or should we get out of the pub, have a pint? Yeah, let's, you know, it's
yeah, or you become the person who everyone comes up to at a party and be like, oh, I've got this really good idea for an app. Wait, maybe you can help me with it.
Yeah. What's your budget? I've got one. Yeah.
20 quid.
Yeah. So no, definitely. I think it's cracking, and it's great to sort of you know, meet you and connect with you. And when, you know, with those COVID things, you know, sorts itself out, it'd be you know, I have to maybe have a trip up to Manchester and come say hello.
Definitely, yeah.
We could do a podcast in the real world with some proper cameras.
We could, face-to-face, exactly. I miss doing them face-to-face, to be honest. I used to really enjoy that as well, so.
Yeah, definitely. But you know what, actually, at the same time, I mean, there's no way, you know, no two ways about it. It's much better when you're actually in front of somebody. But equally, I think what's great about, obviously not what's happened, but the circumstances that we all find ourselves in, we've all been forced to actually look at technology and implement it to carry on doing the things that we were doing. And certainly it's made it more efficient and quicker and better use of time to do a lot of podcasts like this, I think.
Yeah, I think so too.
So, James, listen, I'll wrap it up. Thanks so much for joining me. For anyone still listening, thank you. as usual, don't forget to give us a 5-star review. And please, please, definitely check out James Mulvaney's Matchmaker podcast co and all of his socials. If you look on his LinkedIn account, definitely connect with him, and I'm sure he'll be delighted to jump on the podcast at some point. But James, listen, so much. Thanks so much. And let's keep in touch. And I can't wait to see how it all develops for you.
All right, take it easy.
Cheers, James. Take care, mate.